Welcome to another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. 40 Minutes in the Old Testament is a 1517 Podcast Network podcast. You can go to 1517.org/podcast. Check out all the other podcasts that are living over there. While you're over there, make sure you click on the events page and you want to register for that Here We Still Stand event in Las Vegas, Nevada. That's going to be October 15th and 16th. It's going to be a good time. It's coming up. It's going to be right around the corner. I mean, we're only a little over a month away. By the time this releases, it'll probably be exactly a month away. So make sure that you get signed up if you're not already. It's only $65. Includes your lunch on Saturday. Chad will be there. I'll be there. A whole bunch of other people will be there. It's going to be a good time. Hope to see you there. Chad, David has retaken the throne. Well, he's about to march himself back into Jerusalem. He's done some weird military changes. He's given over the army to the general of his son who was trying to overthrow him and demoted Joab, which Joab's probably not going to be too happy about that. We'll get to that eventually. But right now we got sort of a bunch of reunions.
Yeah, some strange reunions at that. Yeah, so if you remember when Absalom staged the coup, David, of course, had to flee. So he takes off. And as he's leaving on his exodus, as we called it, he encounters all sorts of people. And one of those people that he encounters is the guy named Shimei. Well, when David returns, now that Absalom has been defeated, David is going to encounter Shimei once more. But there's sort of a symmetry between his exodus and his return. So he's going to encounter Shimei, just like he encountered him when he left. And just like he also encountered a guy named Ziva, who is the servant of Mephibosheth, now he's going to encounter Mephibosheth himself. And so we're going to have him interact with Mephibosheth, and we'll kind of diagnose exactly which one of those guys, Mephibosheth or Ziba, is actually telling the truth about the situation. And then David encountered a guy named Ittai, and who was loyal to him, and David is going to encounter a guy named Barzillai, who is loyal to him as well. So there's a symmetry between his leaving Jerusalem and his return to Jerusalem. And kind of the question that we need to ask ourselves as we work our way through each of these conversations is, why is David doing what he does? And is the decision that David makes in each of these cases wise or foolish? Because it's a mixed bag between each of these encounters. And not only that, but especially in the case of Shimei, we need to ask ourselves just how, what's the word I want to use? Sincere, politically motivated, was David's decision here? Because as we'll see in this first encounter, even though David seems to be very magnanimous toward Shimei, who initially cursed him, as it turns out, when you get farther along in the story, it turns out that David was actually holding a grudge against him. So his magnanimity was not entirely sincere when he showed him mercy. But anyway, that's kind of the question we need to ask ourselves is, how does David deal with each of these situations? Were they wise decisions that David made? And what kind of ongoing repercussions might these have as we work our way through the rest of David's life and then also into Solomon's reign? So the first guy is Shimei, the son of Gera. So we're in 2 Samuel 19:16. He's a Benjaminite. He's from a town or a village called Bahurim. These are details we've already encountered before. So when David left, this Shimei character came out, and if you remember, he just laid into David. He cussed him out. He called him every name in the book. He accused him of murdering Saul and Ishbosheth, and just basically violently taking over the kingdom. And David just kind of took it. He was very passive in this whole situation, even though Shimei came at him with just about as violent a verbal attack as you can imagine. Well, now that David has been restored, Shimei is, he realizes, hey, this might be the end for me unless I do something to try and win the king's favor once more, to grovel before him. So he hurries out to come down and meet David on his way back to Jerusalem. And we're not exactly sure why he does this, but he doesn't come alone. He brings 1,000 guys with him, 1,000 other men from the tribe of Benjamin, maybe as protection, maybe as his way of showing, hey, if you're merciful to me, then all these other guys who are with me will also be on your side. That's probably more the latter than the former. Ziba is also there. with his family. So they all go down there to the Jordan to meet the king. And then we read in verse 18 that Shimei prostrates himself before the king when he's about to cross the Jordan. And here's his speech of repentance. "Let not my Lord hold me guilty, or remember how your servant did wrong on the day my Lord the king left Jerusalem. Do not let the king take it to heart, for your servant knows that I have sinned. Therefore, behold, I have come this day, the first of all the house of Joseph, to come down to meet my Lord the king." So there's a couple things I think that are noteworthy here. First of all, it's interesting to me that, so this guy's from the tribe of Benjamin, but notice how he identifies himself. He says, "I've come this day, the first of all the house of Joseph, to meet the king." Now, this is speculation on my part, but I can't help but wonder if maybe the reason he doesn't say the tribe of Benjamin is to stress the fact that I'm coming from the house of Joseph, kind of hinting, hey, Joseph, you remember the guy who was extremely merciful toward his brothers when they had sinned against him?
Yes.
So I'm with that guy, you know, I'm Joseph-like in character. So please, you know, show mercy to me as Joseph showed to his brothers. I mean, like I said, that's a guess on my part, but it is kind of strange that he says he's from the house of Joseph instead of from the tribe of Benjamin. And I guess the second thing to point out is that, I mean, if this was all we knew about him, this particular confession, then I guess we would say it was completely sincere. Given the circumstances, it's hard for me to believe that he really feels bad about what he did, only because he knows he's going to lose his head probably if he doesn't try and pacify the king. Maybe I shouldn't question his motives, but it just, given what he did before and the way that he attributed bloodshed, murder, and all of these terrible things to David, it's difficult for me to believe that he's had this complete change of heart all of a sudden.
It's interesting that he comes out with 1,000 guys, and you might read that and think that that's sort of like some sort of, is that protection for him? Is it a threat? Mm-hmm. I think probably what it is that he's really concerned about losing his head, and yeah, he's going to perform this sort of repentive act in front of all these people. So it's a way of telling David that I'm going to do this in front of all of the people who are with me, right? I'm going to do this in front of my mm-hmm. whole house and that sort of thing. So he makes it very public, as opposed to just going to him in private. There's no way that he'll be able to do this and then go back to his people and pretend like he didn't just, you know, swear allegiance to David or whatever he does. So he does it in front of all of them. That's how I read it anyway.
Yeah.
I don't think he's trying to flex on David or anything here. I think he's trying to make sure that David, he's trying to put everything he can in place to make David believe that this is sincere.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that completely makes sense given the circumstances. So that's what he does. That's what he says. Now, verse 21 tells us not of David's reaction at first, but of Abishai's reaction. So you may remember when Shimei verbally attacked David when he was leaving Jerusalem, Abishai, who remember is the nephew of David, the brother of Joab, Abishai wanted to go over and cut off his head. That was his, he's the guy for whom violence is always the first and best option. So Abishai wanted to cut off Shimei's head when he was cursing David. This time, Abishai basically says more or less the same thing. He says, "Shall not Shimei be put to death for this, because he cursed the Lord's anointed?" So Abishai's still out for blood. He's just that kind of character. So David responds to him similarly to how he responded to him initially. So when Abishai wanted to cut off his Shimei's head when they were fleeing, David said, "Just drop it. Leave me alone. I don't have anything to do with your violent tendencies. And he says more or less the same thing here. He says, what have I to do with you, you sons of Zeruiah, that you should this day be as an adversary to me? Literally in Hebrew, that is a Satan to me, which we get our word Satan. So Satan just means adversary. And it ordinarily commonly refers to human adversaries. So that you should this day be a satan, an adversary to me. Shall anyone be put to death in Israel this day? For do I not know that I am this day king over Israel? So the idea here seems to be that, you know, often when a person became a king at their coronation, they would show clemency to people as a way of kind of starting off on the right foot, as it were. And this seems to be kind of David's idea here. He's like, look, I'm a king over Israel this day, and I've been restored to my throne, and so I'm not going to be going around handing out death penalties. So I'm not going to.
You know, and this reminds you, this is a little thing that David probably learned from Saul. Because Saul does something very similar when
back in 1 Samuel.
There's an opportunity to put a bunch of people to death, and Saul decides to do the right political thing, which is say, nope, I'm king over everybody. And so even the language is the same, where nobody's gonna die today.
Yeah.
You know, like, so you're coming off the heels of a battle where everyone who died was, you know, from the house of Israel. You had David's men fighting with Absalom's men. And this is David sort of doing the same thing that Saul did, which is saying, no more Israelites are dying today.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's a wise political move. It's a magnanimous move. It's a gracious move. And I mean, it's a great reminder to us that, you know, it's David could have done anything. He could have used his power for murder or for execution. But instead, he, like one of the ancient prayers puts it, I don't know if I have the exact words here, but Almighty God, whose power is made known chiefly in showing mercy.
Yeah.
Something like that. So the greatest way to show power, whether it's God showing power or whether it's us who have some sort of power or authority, is actually to display mercy. So David uses his regained power at this kind of second coronation, if you will, to show mercy to Shimei. So that's what he says. King says to Shimei, so he's already addressed Abishai. Now he says to Shimei, you shall not die. And then the king gave him his oath. Now, here's a strange thing. So on this day, David shows mercy to Shimei. But this is what I was referring to a few minutes ago. How sincere was this? How true was this mercy? Because if you go forward in David's life to literally his deathbed, so this is in the first couple chapters of, I think it's in 1 Kings 2, and the very last instructions that David gave to his son Solomon before he died, I mean, his death is recorded immediately after this. The very last instructions he gave to Solomon was basically to deal with Shimei. So on his dying breath is like, hey, you know, Shimei, that guy that cursed me out, I want you to take him out. I want you to take care of him. And that is indeed what Solomon ends up doing. He doesn't just go and arrest him and have him executed. He kind of sets up a scenario. It's sort of a trap that says, all right, you can live if you don't leave Jerusalem. But if you ever leave Jerusalem, you're dead. And after a while, Shimei, in fact, does, and so he's executed. So on down the road, this mercy that David showed to Shimei is reversed, and he actually ends up being taken out, not by David, of course. David had given him his oath, but by David's son.
Yeah, I think we had mentioned this. I think it was off air, but the more you read the life of David, and as David gets older and older, and you realize that David is a horrific argument for progressive sanctification.
He doesn't get better, he gets worse.
Yeah. He's even his deathbed, it's not good.
Yeah, there is this, well, we've seen this in multiple ways. There is this kind of un-David-ing of David. He's coming undone more and more as time goes on. He makes bad decisions, he makes foolish decisions, he ends up doing things which you know, whatever his motives might have been, certainly in the big picture are not good symbolic moves. For instance, I mean, the one we already talked about, he says to Joab, you're not going to be my main guy anymore. It's going to be Amasa. Well, that's just even if he was trying to kind of do the political thing by bringing Amasa on board with him and thus all of Amasa's followers. Okay, fine. But you don't have to make him your commander in chief. You don't have to make him the head general. And he had to have known too that Joab was not going to simply sit idly by when he did that. Yeah, so David he's making a lot of bad decisions at this stage, as he has leading up to this as well. Okay, so that's the first encounter. Next one is with Mephibosheth. Mephibosheth, you remember, is the son of Jonathan. David showed mercy to him. He's unable to walk. He was injured as a child in his feet. But David showed mercy to him, took care of him, gave him a lot of provisions, gave him Ziba to be his servant. Now, when David was fleeing Jerusalem, Mephibosheth's servant Ziba came out to him and basically said that Mephibosheth had become a traitor and that Mephibosheth was going to the side of Absalom and believed that the kingdom was being restored to him. He, the grandson of Saul, that he was going to be the new king. Now, that didn't make any sense when Ziba said it, but David, perhaps because of the turmoil of the times, believed him and basically gave over all of Mephibosheth's property to Ziba. Now, Mephibosheth himself shows up. He comes out to meet the king, and we're told right away that he had neither taken care of his feet, nor trimmed his beard, nor washed his clothes from the day the king departed until the day he came back in safety, which is enough to tell us that Mephibosheth was actually the faithful one here. So everything that he was doing, these are basically signs of grief and mourning. He's not taking care of himself. He's not trimming his beard. He isn't washing his clothes. So he's basically in a perpetual state of mourning over what has happened to David, indicative of the fact that his heart had never been unfaithful to David. He had not been a traitor, unlike David had been informed. So he comes out to meet the king like this. And the king says to him, "Why did you not go with me, Mephibosheth? So, you know, why'd you stay back in Jerusalem?" In other words, implicit here is this that I've heard about you true? And he answers, here's what happened. My lord, O king, my servant deceived me. That is the servant Ziba that had come out and lied to David about Mephibosheth. He deceived me because I said to him, I will saddle a donkey for myself that I may ride on it and go with the king. Because, of course, Mephibosheth is lame. But he goes on, he slandered me to you, my king. For my lord, the king, is like the angel of God. And then he goes on to say, do therefore what seems good to you. For all my father's house were men but doomed to death before my lord, the king. But you set your servant among those who eat at your table. What further right have I then to cry to my king? The essence of which is basically, listen, I wanted to come out to you, but my servant deceived me. It's obvious to you that I can't simply walk out to see you. I had to ride in order to get here, but that didn't happen because my servant deceived me and left me behind. And then he came and lied to you. And so my life is basically in your hands. So do to me, deal with me in whatever way that you see fit. So he is hoping, presumably, he's hoping that David will recognize that his loyalty remained with David and that David will act in such a way that is just and merciful toward him.
Now, I gotta admit, Chad, now David seems conflicted about this, and so maybe he has more information than I do. But based on what we know, I am not on Team Ziba in this particular thing. I think no. I think that probably what we just heard is what happened, because it seems right in line with it just seems like something Ziba would do.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, and nothing has been told to us about Mephibosheth whatsoever, except what Ziba said, that would ever be an indication that he's not fully loyal to David.
It doesn't make any sense. Absalom's not going to give the kingdom to the son of Saul. like that doesn't make any sense to me. Like the lie doesn't make sense.
Yeah, it was not a credible lie. It didn't make any sense. So the whole rationality behind what he claimed was going on with Mephibosheth just doesn't make any sense.
And what Mephibosheth is saying right here is so straightforward. It makes total sense. And sort of his attitude of saying, do whatever you want to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That is, I don't recall Ziba saying such things.
No, no. Yeah. So everything is leading us in that direction. Now, what should David do? Well, I guess David has, you know, a couple of options. One, he could say, I'll tell you what, I'm going to sit down with both of you and we're going to work this out. I'm basically going to be a judge and I'm going to listen to both of you. And, you know, we'll bring other witnesses if we need to. And we're going to get to the bottom of this and we're going to figure out who, because one of you is lying. One of you is lying. One of you is telling the truth. We're going to figure out which is which. Or he could have simply said at that point, you know what you've said makes a whole lot more sense than what your servant said. So I'm going to restore all of your property and all of your land back to you. He could have said that. What does David do instead? David makes an immediate decision, and it's not the decision that, at least from my perspective, seems to be either just or wise. First of all, he seems to interrupt him. He says in verse 29, why speak any more of your affairs? So in other words, enough, shut up. I'm tired of listening to you. I have decided. And here's his decision. You and Ziba shall divide the land. So he basically makes it sort of it's one of these sort of Solomonic decisions. You remember the whole cut the baby in half Solomon story?
Yeah.
So it's like, you know, in that case, you've got two women, two mothers, one with a child dead, one with a child alive. And David says to his servant, take the living child, cut him in half, give half to this woman, give half to the other woman. And that's kind of what David does here. Maybe that's where Solomon learned this particular trick. Now, in the Solomon story, you remember that the real mother said, no, just give the child to the other woman, thus proving by her love and loyalty to her child that she was in fact the true one. Now Mephibosheth does something similar here, but David does not pick up on this. So as soon as David says, divide the land, Mephibosheth said to the king, oh, let him take it all, since my lord the king has come safely home. So he's saying basically, give him the baby, give him all the land, because really what matters to me is that you're back safe and sound.
Well, when you
now, as soon as he said that, David should have said, you know what, never mind, you get it all.
Yeah, well, here's what I think is happening here is Mephibosheth comes out and he's like not cut, he's a mess. Mm-hmm. Which is, I think, supposed to show you that he's been he's been suffering great anxiety over this entire thing, that he's been very concerned. Mm-hmm. About this whole coup. What's interesting is that David sort of interrupts him and said, why speak any more of your affairs? He didn't speak about his affairs at all. Yeah. He didn't say a word about his affairs. He didn't come out there and say, why is Ziba have my land? You need to do something about this. He just comes out there to greet him, looking a mess because he's glad that David's home. And when David says, look, I don't want to hear about these affairs anymore, it seems that what Mephibosheth's doing right here is saying, well, let him take it all. This wasn't about the land.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this wasn't about me. This was about you. I just want you to know that I didn't try and stab you in the back.
Yeah, I don't think he cares about the land. What he cares about is David knowing that he was slandered and lied about, which is another reason why I don't believe Ziba at all. He doesn't seem to care about the fact that his land was now being run by Ziba. He doesn't seem to care about any of that. And I would think that this is, because of that, that David would have made a different decision here, realizing like, oh yeah, wait a minute, now that I think about it, you weren't coming out here asking me for anything. You weren't telling me to fix this. Mm-hmm. I just told you to shut up about your affairs when you weren't actually bringing up any of your affairs. Like I brought them up. Yeah. To me, this is like not that difficult, but again, maybe David has information we don't have, but just reading it seems pretty straightforward to me.
Yeah, based on what we do know, it seems that this is one more decision that a younger and a wiser David would not have made, but an older and a foolish David does, in fact, make. Okay, so that's Shimei, that's Mephibosheth. Now we meet another guy. Don't meet him, we're reminded of him. His name is Barzillai. He's from Gilead. And we were introduced to him when David had fled from Jerusalem. He ends up being actually taken care of by Barzillai and a couple of other people. So Barzillai comes down, and he goes with the king to escort him over the Jordan. Barzillai is an old guy. He's 80 years old. Actually, my dad turns 80 years old this year, so kind of gives me a perspective here on who Barzillai is. And if you remember from Psalm 90, Moses says, you know, God gives us 70 years or 80 if due to strength. So in the Israelite mind, 80 is kind of, you know, you're maxing out there. So 80 is right at the limit. So we're told he'd given food to the king while he stayed at a place called Mahanaim. He was a very wealthy man, so he was able to provide David and his army with the provisions they needed since he had to flee right away. And David wants to bring him back. He's like, come back to Jerusalem with me. I'll take care of you. And Barzillai basically says to the king, no, I'm too old for that. He says, I've lived a lot of years right where I'm at, so why should I go with the king? He says, I'm 80 years old. Then he goes on to say, can I discern what is pleasant, what is not? Can your servant taste what he eats or what he drinks? Can I listen to the voice of singing men and singing women? So in other words, if I went with you, I wouldn't even really be able to enjoy this lavish lifestyle and the capital that you might be able to give to me. I can barely taste my food and my drink. My hearing's gone. I can't hear the voice of singing men and singing women. So why should I be an added burden to you? I'll go with you a little ways to the Jordan. But why should you repay me with such a reward as this? I'll tell you what, verse 37, just let me go home so that I can die in my own city near the grave of my father and my mother. That's really all that I need from you. So thank you, but no thanks. But then he adds this, but you know, I'm presuming this is his son. We're not told. He says, here is your servant, Chimham. Like I said, we're not told, but I'm thinking this is probably Barzillai's son. He says, look, here is presumably my son, your servant, Chimham. Why don't you take him? Instead of me, if you want to show mercy and give this kind of life to someone from my family, well, here you go. You can take him. Let him go with my lord the king and do for him whatever seems good to you. And the king says, more or less, yeah, good idea. He'll go with me. I'll do for him whatever seems good to you. And all that you desire of me, I will do for you. So all the people go over the Jordan. The king goes over. The king kissed Barzillai, blesses him, and then he goes back to his own home. And the king proceeds on with this guy, Chimham. And then at the end of verse 40, we're told this. All the people of Judah, and also not all, but half the people of Israel, brought the king on his way. So this is the third of these encounters. First we had Shimei, next we had Mephibosheth, and now we have Barzillai. And at least in the case of Barzillai, everything seems to be done properly. David does seem to be, you know, he's showing, he wants Barzillai to realize how much he appreciates him going out of his way to take care of him and his men. And he's fine with Barzillai saying, no, I'm too old for that, but take my servant, presumably my son, instead. So all that, you know, All that seems to go well. Where it doesn't go well is at the end, where we're told that the whole tribe of Judah were on David's side, but only half, there's kind of an ominous half, the people of Israel brought the king on his way. Verse 41, what happens next? Then all the men of Israel, so the rest of the people, we might say, all the other tribes of Israel, they came to the king. And here is where the real problems begin with David. So David's has been working his way. You can kind of imagine in your mind, he's on the other side of the Jordan. He's in the Transjordan. He's crossing the river with these people, and he's encountered Shimei. He showed him mercy, at least temporarily. He encounters Mephibosheth, makes an unwise decision there, splits his property. So he moves on a little farther. He does the whole thing with Barzillai. And now we have a mass gathering. And the people of Judah, David's own tribe, remember, had come to him at David's request. And now we have all these other tribes showing up. And we're about to have this huge verbal altercation between all these people, basically warring over who does David belong to? And is this loyalty only with the tribe of Judah, or is this loyalty with all of us? And the kind of the glaring thing in these last few verses, the thing that which isn't mentioned explicitly, but is just kind of looming there in the background, is this: David's silence. He doesn't say anything. So all the men of Israel come to the king, and hear, and notice who they are addressing. They said to the king this: why have our brothers, the men of Judah, stolen you away and brought the king and his household over the Jordan and all David's men with him? So in other words, why did we get left out? You know, why was this just a tribe of Judah kind of thing restoring you? So they ask the king this, but notice he responds. It doesn't say, and the king answered and said, it says, all the men of Judah answered the men of Israel, because the king is our close relative. Why then are you angry over this matter? Have we eaten it all at the king's expense, or has he given us any gift? In other words, has he shown us favoritism? So that's their response. Then the men of Israel answer the men of Judah. Look, we've got 10 shares in the king. In other words, there's 10 of our tribes. And in David also, we have more than you. So why did you despise us? Were we not the first to speak of bringing back our king? And then the chapter ends with these ominous words. But the words of the men of Judah were fiercer or harder than the words of the men of Israel. In other words, they just kind of outshouted them, we might say. Now, what strikes me as the most important thing here, which I already indicated, is that David says nothing. It's like he's just kind of standing there watching all these guys yell at each other about who is more loyal to David, and, you know, whether the tribe of Judah kind of has, you know, dibs on him, and why weren't they involved in bringing David back? And the situation, this is important because of what we're going to see happen in chapter 20. The situation is dire because you have this growing chasm between the tribes. And what's going to happen is we'll see that this chasm widens in chapter 20. And it probably could have been averted had David spoken up and, you know, done what he would have done as a younger man. I mean, when you think about when David became king, what did he do? He brought all the tribes together, right? He was trying to bring cohesion to the 12 tribes. And here we see him sitting by idly and mutely while once more there's a rift happening between the tribes of Israel.
Yeah, I mean, what you have is you have a group of people that feel that like a little betrayed because they weren't included in the way that they thought they should have been. This also shows you that David's not thinking things through entirely. Like, this is probably a foreseeable thing. But certainly David is the only one who could say something to fix this. And you have to figure out a way to get this family reunion like fully going on. And David doesn't do any of that.
Yeah, that's a great analogy. Yeah, so the cousins here are the Israelites, and the brothers are the Judahites. And if you remember back when Absalom was kind of stirring the pot and telling people that, hey, you know, if I were in charge, you'd be getting justice, a lot of the people he focused on were the Israelites, not the people of Judah. So there was already kind of, and you can see how this would happen, there was already kind of this perception that David was a lot more pro-Judah than he was pro rest of the tribes.
Right.
I mean, that was what kind of created this whole horrible civil war that was happening. And now, I mean, we're on the brink of it happening again. And yeah, in the midst of this family reunion where you have all of these different parties arguing, David doesn't stand up and say, listen, today's a day for peace. Listen, I'm the king. Not just to the tribe of Judah, I'm the king of everybody. I'm the king of the entire 12 tribe nation of Israel. So let's rejoice that we are one family. Let's get along. Let's together go back to Jerusalem and be the nation that God wants us to be. I mean, it didn't have to be anything flowery and eloquent. All David had to do was say something, and yet he doesn't. He stands mutely and idly by. So what happens? Well, we have a chapter break here. We are just transitioning into chapter 20, but it's kind of a it's a chapter break that shouldn't be there, I guess is the way I would put it. I mean, it's like this isn't like some new part of the story. This is the ongoing story that we've already encountered here at the end of chapter 19. Because verse 1 of chapter 20 begins this way. Now there happened to be there, that is, happened to be in the midst of all this going on, a worthless man. We've encountered this several times. This is
nothing good happens when a worthless man shows up in the Old Testament.
Yeah, anytime you have a son of Belial, or as it is here, an Ish Belial, a man of Belial, not going to be good. So, like the Eli, sons of Eli were all worthless guys. So we have a worthless man here. You know, yes, when that happens, things are not going to go well. So there's a worthless guy here. His name was Sheba, however you want to say his name, son of Bichri. He was from the tribe of Benjamin. And I guess seizing the opportunity, he decides, you know what? I'm going to be the one who is the next Absalom, more or less.
Yeah. So give me that trumpet. So he's gonna do this dramatically.
Yeah. He's not just gonna like make a speech. He grabs a trumpet and he blows the trumpet. The same thing that happened back in the beginning of the coup of Absalom in chapter 15. Absalom signaled his coup by blowing the trumpet. So Sheba's gonna do the same thing. He blows a trumpet. And then he gives this speech. We have no portion in David. And we meaning him and the other tribes, the non-Judah tribes, we have no portion in David. And we have no inheritance in the son of Jesse. Every man to his tents, O Israel. Now, what's interesting about this particular speech is that if you go forward to 1 Kings chapter 12. So David's dead, Solomon's dead, and his son Rehoboam has taken over the throne. So this is Rehoboam, David's grandson. David's grandson Rehoboam, when he becomes king, he thinks that he's going to be Mr. Tough Guy and he's going to rule with an iron fist. And what happens is it totally rips the kingdom in two. And when it does, this is the language of 1 Kings 12:16. All Israel saw that the king did not listen to them, and the people answered the king in these words, "What portion do we have in David? We have no inheritance in the son of Jesse. To your tents, O Israel, look now to your own house, David." So they more or less co-opted this speech of Sheba from back in 2 Samuel 20 to signal the fact that they were once more going to break away from the tribe of Judah. And in that case, it worked. In the 1 Kings 12 case, it worked because at that point, for the rest of the kings, we have the northern tribes and the southern tribes. We have Israel in the north and Judah in the south. Now, as we'll see, and we'll have to end pretty quickly here, as we'll see as the rest of this chapter unfolds, it's not going to work out so well for Sheba. It did work out at least somewhat well for the northern tribes. They at least were able to continue for a while. But Sheba's not going to last very long. But he's the first one to say this, that we have no portion in David. We have no inheritance, the son of Jesse, every man to his own tents. We're gonna take care of ourselves. But you can see here that, you know, things could have been different. And I know it's easy to second guess the actions of leaders when they make them in these kind of situations. But everything that we know from this narrative suggests that everything could have been a lot different if David had not just shown some mercy, but acted with some wisdom as far as bringing some cohesion to the nation. But this is kind of the ongoing impact of the prophecy of Nathan. He said, there'd be a sword in your own house. Well, there's a sword that's kind of in the house of Israel. In the big Israel here, because there's more and more of a division happening.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like a lot of this is coming from Judah is a little bit skeptical of the other tribes, because that's who Absalom went after. There's a lot of broken trust there. And so even though everyone's family, the family is, the circles are getting tighter, so they're Judah's, as you know, is saying, well, we got to protect David a little bit, and we know that we can trust the inner circle here, and these people have a lot of ground to make up, and that is probably not the right move to make if you're trying to be a united kingdom.
No, it's not gonna work. In fact, it's gonna ricochet back to them. In fact, and I mean, we'll talk about this in the next episode. We'll see that, you know, this insurrection is stomped out by our friend Joab, but you know, there's no healing that takes place. I guess is the point that I want to make. There really won't be any healing for the rest of Israel's history as far as like any kind of cohesive nation. But yeah, you can kind of see where there's mistrust and all of that brewing in the background here. But unfortunately, the problems were not healed. We're just kind of left there to fester for some time.
Yeah, and I guess next week we'll get into the ramifications of blowing the trumpet and giving this sort of one sentence speech, and we'll see how this all turns out. But we'll have to wait until next week for that. I'll see you then, Chad.
All right, see you then.